This is 40A&M N5, a weekly download of 40A&M LLC. For more information and for our terms of use, visit 40A-M.com. The U.S. Senate fails to move to floor debate on NSA surveillance reforms. High-definition film speeds, making the lives of top motion picture animators a bit more challenging. And farming and the Internet of Things, a big data development this week. All this and more, this is 40A&M in 5, the weekly download of 40A&M LLC. It's Monday, November 24th, and I'm Chris Bohm. First up, on Tuesday of this past week, the Senate voted to block a sweeping overhaul of National Security Agency surveillance of American phone records. As reported in the Washington Post, the New York Times, Politico, and others, Democrats and a handful of Republican senators who supported the reform did not achieve the 60 votes necessary to proceed to floor debate on the legislation, called the USA Freedom Act. The vote was 58-42. The bill had grown out of the surveillance revelations disclosed by NSA contractor Edward Snowden, and under its terms, the NSA would no longer be collecting America's phone records, but instead the records would have stayed in the hands of the phone companies. Many retain such data already for their business purposes, up to 18 months, and the legislation would not have required longer. It would have permitted analysts to continue to perform so-called contact chaining, in which the NSA could possibly trace the suspect's network of acquaintances, but only with a new kind of court order, and only for those records that were linked to a suspect by a distance of no more than two layers removed. The legislation would have also required disclosure of important rulings of the FISA court, permit greater company reporting on surveillance orders, require new transparency reporting from government on surveillance activities, and create a special advocate to support privacy rights before the FISA court. The Republican-controlled House of Representatives had passed a version of the draft legislation in May of this year, but it had been largely watered down prior to passage, and in turn, it had lost the support of many civil liberties groups as well as significant industry support. The legal basis for the phone surveillance program, under which the activities have occurred, a provision of the USA Patriot Act, expires in June. After that, the FISA court will not be able to issue a new set of 90-day orders to require phone companies to hand over the relevant records. Principal author of the bill, Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont, emphasized that he saw the measure's opponents as fomenting fear, stifling serious debate, and constructive solutions, adding that he will not give up the fight, and underscored his own bona fides on these issues by highlighting that 13 years ago, he was the target of an anthrax-laden letter that killed the one person who opened it. Republican leader and incoming Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky was among the bill's chief opponents, despite widespread support not only from the administration, but also from a coalition of technology companies, including Apple, Google, Microsoft, Yahoo, and the influential Center for Democracy and Technology. In objecting to the surveillance reforms of the draft bill, Senator McConnell reportedly said that this is the worst possible time to be tying our hands behind our backs, a comment that succinctly expressed the concerns of those who argued that the programs were a vital tool in the fight against terrorism. Other opponents, like Senator Saxby Chambliss, Republican of Georgia, also believed that the measure went too far in curbing the NSA, while still others, like Senator Rand Paul, Republican of Kentucky, objected to the legislation simply because he believed that it did not go far enough. What happens next is very much an unknown. One senior administration official reportedly told the Washington Post that everybody thinks it's done for this Congress. As reported by the New York Times, 11 new Republicans will join the Senate in 2015, and some of these might alter the debate. Cory Gardner of Colorado, who will replace Mark Udall, one of the staunchest advocates of NSA changes, is reported by the Times as being supportive of ending the bulk collection. And Steve Daines, incoming Republican senator from Montana, also reportedly supported, with Mr. Gardner, a contentious proposal to strip funding for bulk collection when the House took up the issue this past year. Florida Senator Marco Rubio had voted against the measure, calling it a reaction to misinformation and alarmism. But interestingly, Republican Ted Cruz of Texas, like Mr. Rubio, also a possible presidential contender, voted yes to the measure, saying that it is an imperative that we stand together protecting the Bill of Rights. Meanwhile, the number of firms that In the wake of the surveillance revelations and concerns regarding transparency, high-profile data breaches, and continuing onslaught of cybercrimes, have moved this week to encrypt their services, including Apple and Google, continues to increase. This past week, the firm WhatsApp, which Facebook had purchased in October for $22 billion, announced that it has now turned on encryption systems to protect messages sent with an Android version of its popular instant messaging app. The encryption system is called TextSecure, and Open Wister Systems, which developed the technology, told Wired magazine that its use by WhatsApp represents the largest deployment of end-to-end encryption ever. In a separate but related development, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, a global privacy advocacy organization, has unveiled a project entitled Let's Encrypt, which aims to produce software tools that will, as much as possible, automate the process of using the web's standard encryption systems. Let's Encrypt has reportedly been developed with the help of Mozilla, Cisco, Akamai, and others, and is slated to launch in 2015. This is the first time that we've done a story that includes bits of reporting from both National Public Radio and Ag Week. But there it is. Dan Charles of NPR and Ag Week both did excellent stories this past week on an issue on which big data companies all seem to be in agreement. And that's that farmers should be in control of their own data. This past week, Privacy and Security Principles for Farm Data was released. And some of the biggest names in agriculture, including Monsanto and DuPont, the Soybean Association, the National Corn Growers Association, and the National Farmers Union, among others, were all in agreement on its terms. The fact that data increasingly drives U.S. farm operations is no secret. Tractors, combines, and harvesters, among other equipment, all carry sensors that record information and often upload this data to the cloud. Things that often detail what happens on each spot in a farmer's field, from how much fertilizer and seed it received to how much grain it produced and to what type of soil is found there. All of this information, once analyzed, can help drive decisions as to what seeds a farmer should plant, and when to rotate planting locations, and to when to plant. Many of the companies involved in last week's sweeping agreement are also in the business of helping farmers collect the data from their fields and analyzing it at a price. But farmers and their advocates have been wary of what data companies will do with the newfound ability to monitor what's happening on vast tracts of farmland, apart from the tasks that this farmer wants to be signed on to. The companies and associations signing the agreement have agreed that farmers own the data from their own farms, which is a key threshold concession. And as such, they have the right to control who gets access to that data. Now, for instance, farmers can prevent their data from being shared with other businesses or included in larger data collections, a choice that was often in the past left to farmers to negotiate, if they could, piecemeal, and on their own with either of these interests. Also importantly, the agreement will prohibit companies from using the data they collect, such as data from an ongoing harvest, to speculate in commodities markets, an issue which, according to NPR's reporting, proved one of the easiest to solve. Last week, we reported on Robert Hannigan, the new chief of Britain's digital spy agency GCHQ, and his remarks that were critical of U.S. tech industry and its level of assistance to law enforcement, calling them the new command and control center for extremist groups. This week, according to the BBC's Dave Lee, Prime Minister David Cameron has ramped up the pressure on that country's internet service provider industry to strengthen their content filters by adding a public reporting button, one that could be used by net users to flag terrorism-related material. In theory, this would work similarly to the reporting button that presently allows the public to flag instances of child sexual exploitation on the net. Prime Minister Cameron's message was delivered in part to the Australian Parliament, where he said this past week that he was putting technology companies under pressure to deal particularly with jihadist material, saying, "In the UK, we are pushing them to do more, including strengthening filters, improving reporting mechanisms, and being more proactive in taking down harmful material." According to the BBC, these proposed measures are believed to flow from a meeting held last month. However, the BBC understands that while ISPs have agreed in principle to do more to prevent extremism, they have not actually committed to the measures outlined by Number 10. Prime Minister Cameron added that, "We are making progress, but there is further to go, as this is their social responsibility," he said. "We expect them to live up to it." All major ISPs in the UK must offer customers the option to filter out certain types of content, such as pornography or gambling, But whereas the same filtering technology might work for a larger set of potential content, many of the extremist groups use channels like YouTube and Twitter, which are, of course, popular for purely legal reasons. One advocacy organization, the Open Rights Group, told the BBC that we need the government to be clear about what sites they are intending to block, why they are blocking, and whether there will be redress for site owners who believe that their website has been blocked incorrectly. Angelique Carson, correspondent to the Privacy Advisor, an online publication of the International Association of Privacy Professionals, briefed us this past week with an article on a panel discussion, a talk between the Federal Trade Commissioner, Julie Brill, and Article 29 Working Party Chair, Isabelle Falk-Pierrotin, that occurred in Brussels on November 19th. The public talk was an important one, in part because Commissioner Brill had not only been a voice of reasoned support for the efforts undertaken by the FTC to fulfill its enforcement obligations under the EU-US Safe Harbor Privacy Agreement, but also because she has been a vocal proponent that the US needs to do more in terms of baseline legislation to address privacy issues and to do so in a way that does not harm innovation and continued growth for the tech sector, a frequent complaint regarding EU rules. For her part, Ms. Falk-Pierrotin also serves as chair of France's Data Protection Authority, the CNIL, one of the most robust and activist privacy regulators in Europe. And while she might politely agree with Ms. Brill that she and her European colleagues are similarly concerned regarding potential risks involving big data and the separate but high-interest issues of government surveillance, there has long been a vast transatlantic chasm regarding ways to address very similar privacy concerns. Among the criticisms lodged in Europe regarding U.S. enforcement of the EU-U.S. Safe Harbor Agreement, and what many in Europe see as lax enforcement of its seven principles, is a multi-point assessment of the agreement released by former Commissioner Viviane Reding earlier this year, a point-by-point call for 13 recommended improvements for the U.S. to address. Commissioner Brill made a point of emphasizing that it would be very unfortunate for the Safe Harbor mechanism to go away, particularly as it has formed the hook for the FTC to offer greater protection to European data, adding that, like anything with some age on it, the 15-year-old tool can certainly be re-examined and improved, a task that the U.S. Department of Commerce and the FTC both take very seriously, she said. In addition, Ms. Falk-Pierrotin emphasized that Europe wants clear answers on what has been brought about by the Snowden revelations on surveillance issues, adding that the DPAs are expecting real answers. Ms. Carson's synopsis for the Privacy Advisor also noted that Commissioner Brill made particular mention of the Big Data report released earlier this year by the task force helmed by the White House's John Podesta. Her underscore here is that if we want the benefits of big data, and there of course are many, to come to fruition, consumers are going to have to trust it, and that trust cannot be fostered except through transparency. Privacy by design was also emphasized, and the commissioner said that companies should rely less on notice and choice models when seeking user consent, thereby placing too heavy of a burden on the consumer, and instead look to a risk-based approach. This emphasis on risk-based approaches to data regulation and handling is not new. A criticism of the European model has long been made that it relies too heavily on hard and fast notice, choice, and consent rules that are disassociated from concepts of risk. However, in the context of big data analytics, an emphasis on risk, though appropriate for purposes of advancing consumer attention, also presents difficulty given the risk attributable to datasets in a big data environment often has less to do with the datasets themselves than with their combination, analysis, and decisions taken upon that analysis. When Falk-Pierrotin said that big data is not just a new way to process data, it's a real historical breakthrough, she is not kidding. Though Falk-Pierrotin sees no proof or evidence that European principles are no longer valid, she said. On the contrary, as reported by Angelique Carson, in each of our countries we are already working on big data applications using our principles. She would, however, like to see the EU catch up on the US on breach notification. As Commissioner Brill had noted, that 47 US states currently have such rules in place. On November 8th, the BBC's Mark Ward covered an intriguing new conundrum being faced by film industry digital animators, and that is the advent of 4K high frame rate film technology. Current animated movies are produced to be viewed at 24 frames per second and at a resolution of about 2K. The advent of technology such as 4K and frame rates of 48 frames per second and higher is a big difference. In order to be accessible to the new 4K technology, the resolution of animated films, according to the BBC, would need to be increased by about 2.5 times, and simply scaling up the existing images to close the gap would look horrible. The challenge for animators, according to the BBC, is to produce scenes that are more detailed so that they look good at these much higher resolutions and film speeds. While higher speed computers and networks have alleviated some of the pressures, the time it takes to create the frames is still the primary limiting factor in determining how quickly a film can be completed. For instance, the BBC cited the animation firm Illumination, which currently has 20,000 computers in what it calls Render Farm, which are used by animators to produce these individual images and scenes that eventually become a movie. But shipping these high-resolution images back and forth to animators consumes huge amounts of memory. For instance, the BBC cites that in 2007, the total amount of memory used while the Illumination company worked on its Dragon Hunters movie peaked at about 12 terabytes. Most recently, the amount of memory used peaked at roughly 680 terabytes when Illumination made Despicable Me 2. In theory, according to the BBC's Mark Ward, the simplest strategy would be to use the fastest memory, which is flash memory. However, 600 terabytes of all flash memory would simply be cost prohibitive. The economics simply do not support it. And that will be all for us again this week. You have been listening to 48mn5. For more information and for our terms of use, visit 408-m.com. All stories for this week's download were reported by at least two online or print news sources, or taken directly from relevant releases, with the exception of specific reporting highlighted from The Washington Post, Wired Magazine, the BBC, The New York Times, Ag Week, National Public Radio, and the Privacy Advisor of the International Association of Privacy Professionals. Thank you for listening. 48mn5 will be off next week, but we'll be back with you again on Monday, December 8th. For all those celebrating this coming week, happy Thanksgiving. And of course, make this week and every week one to remember. And bye for now.